Romans chapter 12, please join me there in Romans chapter 12. Continuing our series through the book of Romans, we've hit pay dirt, so to speak. We get to Romans 12, and he's getting into the more practical part of the book. A lot of the more difficult sections are behind us, and now we're getting to the now what? Now here's what we got to do. And so today we're continuing in Romans chapter 12. And I want to point out as we begin how active this chapter is. Notice verse 1. I appeal to you therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. A living sacrifice, not a dead sacrifice. Not a laying on the altar sacrifice, but living and active. And that's the kind of sacrifice that we are to be. Now look at verse 6. Having gifts that differ according to the grace given us, let us use them. If prophecy, in proportion to our faith. If service in our serving. The one who teaches in his teaching. The one who exhorts in his exhortation. The one who contributes in generosity. The one who leads with zeal. The one who does acts of mercy with cheerfulness. That's a very active verse, isn't it? You got gifts? Use them. Verse 10. From last week's lesson. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Verse 13. Contribute to the needs of the saints and seek to show hospitality. Verse 20. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. This, as you just read through this chapter, the whole thing is a call to action. The earlier parts of the book may be sort of heady. In the sense of trying to wrap your mind around what does it mean to be saved by faith. You know, that's sort of deep. You can spend a long time thinking about all that and the arguments he makes and how the example of Abraham, it's just stuff to kind of turn over in your mind and chew on. But we get to chapter 12 and it's like, now here's what you got to do. And it is a list of things to get out and be after it and to put these things into practice. And it's not just an academic exercise. It's not just something to memorize or to discuss or debate, but it's something that is to motivate us. And that is what we'll be looking at in today's verses, which are 11 and 12, which are kind of a kick in the pants. Verse 11 says, do not be slothful in zeal. Be fervent in spirit. Serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope. Be patient in tribulation. Be constant in prayer. Those two verses will be the text for our lesson this morning. Mainly we'll look at the verse 11 first, and then the motivation to get fired up in verse 12. So the first thing he says is don't be lazy. Don't be slothful in zeal. The New King James says not lagging in diligence. Someone who's lagging, you know what it means to lag, and we won't lag along, right? That's tag along or something. Anyway, lagging, it's like, no, you fall behind. Everybody's working, but here's somebody's lagging behind the rest of everybody else. They're not keeping up. Not pulling their weight. The word slothful is used there. The word sloth has been given to an animal, of course, and they're popular on the internet because they're so fun to watch how they just sort of, you know, creep. And there's even that Zootopia movie that was made with some of the characters were sloths, and one of them works at the DMV, of course, and you go in there and he's just, you know, and that's sort of the whole joke of the whole thing is that he just can't move very quickly. And that, I think that's a good picture of what it means to be slothful is to be like that, just slow. And this idea of lagging behind in zeal, just kind of dragging your feet. You know, we've all probably been there and we probably all worked with people like that. And it's frustrating and irritating, isn't it? If you have a job to do and there's a group of people working and some people just aren't really trying. And you got people who are really hustling and working, but you look around and other people are kind of standing over in the shade, or they hide from work, or they do something, whatever task you give them, they're going to spread that task out as long as they can. This is going to take me till lunch to do this thing I've got to do, and then maybe I'll be done after that. And that's this idea of just lagging behind where you kind of constantly trying to say, come on, you know, or you see the team is running and there's those one or two kids that are halfway back around from the rest of them, and they're just hardly trying at all, and it's frustrating. If you're one of the ones who's really excited and giving it your effort, and then you look around, somebody's kind of dragging their feet and not excited. And that's what he says here. Don't be slothful in zeal. This word slothful is similar to the word in the Old Testament, a sluggard. And maybe, I don't know if sluggard is related to the animal slug or not, but it's the same thing. How fast does a slug move? About maybe even slower than a sloth, I would guess, right? They just don't seem to hardly be going anywhere at all. But there's a proverb that says, like vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes, so is the sluggard to those who send him. There's a little lesson in that just about being a worker, that you don't want to be this guy. You don't want to be that person that when someone gives you a job to do, it's just so annoying. It's like drinking vinegar or like smoke burning your eyes, having to deal with you because you're lazy. That's certainly not anything that glorifies God, and that's not the way of a Christian, and that's not what we want to be. We want to be hard workers. And so in the New Testament passage, though, what we're talking about is being a sluggard or being slothful when it comes to serving the Lord. And if this paints a picture of how annoying it is for the master or the supervisor to have to deal with someone who is slothful, then I want to show you how in the New Testament we see the Lord feels the same way about it in his service. In Matthew chapter 25, if you would turn there, hold your place, and we'll be back to Romans 12, of course. But Matthew 25, and we're going to be looking at the parable of the talents. I'm going to skip through to the one talent man. So you remember the setup to this, right? There's a man who's going away on a long journey. And so he divides up his possessions among three of his servants to look after those things. There's one who gets five, one who gets two, one who gets one talent. Talent was a big unit of money. When he comes back, they're called in to give an account. What'd you do with my stuff while I was gone? So the five talent man had put his to work. The two talent man had put his to work. And they were both blessed and, you know, rewarded for their efforts. But we come to the one talent man. Verse 24. He also who had received the one talent came forward saying, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid. And I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here you have what is yours. But his master answered him, you wicked and slothful servant. By the way, that's the same word in our passage for Romans 12. It's only used three times in the New Testament in the Greek. This is one of the other two. So here's, you wicked and slothful servants. The same idea, not slothful in zeal in our passage today. You knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers. At my coming, I should have received that was my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more will be given. He will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into outer darkness. In that place will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. This gives us a pretty vivid picture, does it not, of how the master feels about laziness. So let's take a closer look at this. I think as we dig into this depiction of the one talent man, there's more here than maybe even meets the eye. As you look at the slothful servant, does he see any of this situation as being his fault? Can you hear what he's saying there? I knew you were a hard man, and I was afraid, and so I went and hid. So he's not to blame. I mean, it's certainly not anything wrong with him. Where's the problem? Problem is with you, Master. You are a hard man. And that is an interesting picture. Now, this is a parable, so it is just a story that has a message. And we probably don't want to make the mistake of reading too much into all the little nitty-gritty details. But it's interesting to consider that the scenario that Jesus is painting. The servant says, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you have not sowed, gathering where you scattered no seed. What does that imply? They already had a relationship before this, right? That he knows something about the master. He knows what the master expects. And from the servant's point of view, the master expects too much, right? And then from the servant's point of view, the master's hard to work for. And even this idea that you reap where you haven't sowed and you gather where you scattered no seed, you can imagine a scenario where the master is telling the servant, pick that up, get that over there. And the servant's kind of talking, well, you didn't even plan over there. You didn't even, you know, that's extra. That's more, that's above and beyond what we should have to do. And so he's probably complaining, and you get the picture that these two have a tense relationship already, because the servant says when he's asked about it, well, I knew what kind of boss you are. Now, from the point of view of a lazy person, it's always that the boss is a miserable person to work for. Have you ever noticed that? They can't stand the boss. But that dynamic is really sometimes driven more by the fact that the boss, of course, is frustrated, and that sets their relationship off on the wrong foot. And he says, I knew that you were too demanding, but is the boss too demanding of him? In fact, it says in the setup to the whole thing that he apportioned to each according to his ability. The five talent man got five, the two got two. This guy gets one. That means the boss knew who he was dealing with, right? He understood this guy's abilities. And so he doesn't expect too much out of the one talent man. In fact, he doesn't even expect as much out of him as he does the other two. And I think that shows us that the Lord's not expecting more than people are able to deliver, right? He isn't like saying, well, you've got to do what she does. You've got to do what he does. No, it's just each person. And he knows what we're capable of. And he's not expecting more than we're able to do. And he hasn't set the bar so high that it's impossible. That's what this one time is. I was like, well, you know, there was no way anyway. You're just so hard to work for. I couldn't be pleasing anyway. So I didn't do anything. Because it's your fault. Because you're too demanding. Well, that's not at all true of the Lord. He doesn't expect more than we're able to do. Notice the one talent man makes this excuse that he was afraid. He was scared. But it's interesting that the master doesn't even acknowledge that excuse. When he responds, he calls him wicked and slothful and worthless. He doesn't even, he doesn't even say anything about this excuse that he was afraid. He says, you were lazy. Now, for someone who's lazy, any excuse is a good excuse, right? For someone who's lazy, I was afraid. Well, maybe you were. Maybe you were really actually just lazy. And that's what the master says about it. It wasn't that the job was too frightening to manage this one talent. It was that he didn't want to do it. Thirdly, notice that he hid the talent in the ground. And I've never thought about this before, but I'm sure he did that pretty much right away, don't you imagine? And then what did he do? Well, we aren't told, but the master was gone on a long journey. So can't you imagine that this servant took that talent and he buried it and he went on about whatever he felt like doing, don't you think? And however long the master was gone, he was doing something, but he wasn't doing the master's business, right? So when the master comes back, he digs up that talent that had been buried all that time. He says, here. But what had he done? He had done nothing. He had probably been doing something, but whatever he occupied himself with, it had nothing to do with the responsibility that the master had left him with before he left. And that's the problem. It had been buried in the ground and neglected completely. And he hadn't done anything about it until the day of reckoning. And then finally, I think that what the one-talent man says is interesting. He brings that talent to him and he says, here, you have what is yours. And if I understand what he's saying, he's saying, I didn't short you, right? He didn't steal the money. He didn't waste it. He didn't give it away. He didn't misuse it in some, harebrained scheme. He protected it, and now he's bringing it back, and he's saying, we're square. Here, this is what you gave me. I'm giving it back to you. It's just as it was when you gave it to me. I did you no wrong. I didn't hurt you, and you can almost read it between the lines. You can't be mad at me, right? You can't be angry with me because I've protected your precious talent, and here you've got it back, and now, whew, you're all square and we're good. And the master says, you could have at the very least been put it in the bank and it would have got some interest. You could have done something. So his failure wasn't that he did something horrible or hurtful. His failure was he didn't do anything, right? That was where he went wrong. It wasn't that he had harmed the master, or he had been a poor steward in the sense of wastefulness, or he had been stealing or using it for himself. He didn't do any of that. From his own point of view, you can almost imagine that he thinks, I haven't done anything wrong. I mean, he may not be happy, but he can't be mad. And yet we see that obviously the master is furious and he calls him worthless and slothful and has him thrown out because he had done nothing with the talent that had been given to him. And it reminds me back now, let's go back to Romans chapter 12. When we think about talents and what that might mean, Notice in verse 6, he says, having gifts that differ according to the grace given to us, let us use them. That is, it almost seems like it was pulled from the parable of the talents. So in the parable of talents, each one was given various things depending on their abilities. In Romans 12, he says, we have different gifts according to his various grace. And they're not all the same. He lists some of them there. Some people serve. Some people are generous. Some people show acts of kindness. Some people are leaders. Some people exhort. There's all different kinds of gifts and opportunities and abilities people have. They're not all the same. They're not compared the same. It's just a matter of whatever you've been given, let us use them, right? So is there a talent somewhere that I buried in the backyard that I'm not doing anything with, that I'm going to have to give account for one day and say, well, what did you do? Well, whatever excuse you think you're going to make, it isn't going to hold any water, because the Lord knows what we are capable of. Now, the next expression is equally powerful. Back down in verse 12, he says, verse 11, Romans 12, verse 11. Do not be slothful in zeal. That's what we just looked at. By the way, that zeal there, of course, is your go-get-it attitude. Be fervent in spirit. Serve the Lord. I like this word fervent. I was wondering what it means. Fervent. The Greek word is zeo, Z-E-O. That doesn't mean much to us, right? Probably nothing to us because we don't speak Greek. But the word zeo is an interesting word, because if it's referring to a liquid, it means heated to a point of boiling. Referring to a solid, it means heated to the point where it's glowing. So it's something that has been heated up. So a boiling pot was zeo if it was boiling, and a piece of metal you're working with is glowing. Well, that's zeo. That's what the word means. It's heated up to the point of glowing. And so he's saying here that your spirit is to be on fire, basically, heated up, boiling. I thought about it and I decided against using a picture of E.T. with his little chest glowing. You know, I thought, well, maybe that would be more distracting than helpful. But the idea is that we're glowing. Our spirit's fired up. You know, and they have pep rallies for teams, right? And what is the point of that? Get fired up. Because if we go out there and we're just kind of, oh, well, that's not very good. How good are we going to do? But you get everybody fired up, and you have hype, and you have the music, and you get people are chanting, jumping up and down. And the whole thing is to somehow get some kind of a fire lit under you. Brother Green told a story of being in North Korea, probably South Korea. But anyway, being in Korea during the Korean conflict, before there was North and South. And there was a man who had a horse, and he said he was a poor horse. And I guess he was just real, whatever a poor horse would be. And he was overloaded, and this guy was trying to get him to carry some load up a hill. And this horse just couldn't hardly go, and finally he just stopped. And he stood there, and no amount of pushing or poking or prodding could get that horse to take another step. And he literally gathered up some stuff and built a fire under the horse to try to make him go. And he said the horse just stepped off to the side of it. Like, that's all he would. But anyway, you hear about people like build a fire and light a fire under somebody. But the whole point is try to get you to move, right? And here he says, be fervent in spirit. Now, what does it look like if a person is fervent in spirit? We have, fortunately, an example of this exact expression used for someone. It's in Acts chapter 18. So turn with me there to Acts chapter 18. We'll look at what's a picture of somebody who's fervent in spirit? This is Apollos. And notice what we read about Apollos in Acts chapter 18, beginning in verse 24. Now, a certain Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, came to Ephesus. He was an eloquent man, competent in the scriptures. He had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and being fervent in spirit. There's our expression. Fervent in spirit. He spoke and taught accurately the things concerning Jesus, though he knew only the baptism of John. And he began to speak boldly in the synagogue, but when Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they took him aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately. And when he wished to cross to Achaia, the brothers encouraged him and wrote to the disciples to welcome him. When he arrived, he greatly helped those who through grace had believed, for he powerfully refuted the Jews in public, showing by the scriptures that the Christ was Jesus. Okay, here's a man who's got some talent, right? We talk about talents. Notice what his talents are. He, it says, was an eloquent man, verse 24, and competent in the scriptures. So he had a natural gift of speaking, of oratory. He was an eloquent speaker. And He was competent. So he was taught. He had a combination of things here. He had a talent for speaking, and now he had the education to go with it. And he had an understanding and a knowledge. But just an ability to do something and the knowledge to do it doesn't really turn into very much if you don't have any motivation, right? But he has a combination of things. He is eloquent, he's competent and instructed, and he's fervent in spirit. Now we've got a winning combination, right? You got somebody that has the ability, somebody that has the knowledge, and you've got somebody that's highly motivated. And what's that person going to do? Well, in the case of Apollos, notice that it says he spoke boldly in verse 26. So he's boldly out there speaking. And then down in verse 27-28, he greatly helped those who had believed, and he powerfully refuted the Jews in public. And so you see a boldness that comes as a result of his fervency. That the fact that his spirit's boiling over, is glowing, that he's fired up about things, is he is zealous for the Lord. And this is not something that was sort of self-seeking. You see his humility, don't you? Because he was mistaken about some things. And a lot of times somebody that was a powerful, eloquent speaker that's moving people, and you get some person in the audience that's going to come up and set you straight, a lot of those people would be like, who do you think you are trying to tell me something different, right? But he listened to Priscilla and Aquila, and they taught him. He listened to what they said. He fixed what his message was. He went on doing powerfully what he was doing. It's sort of when you find somebody that is internally motivated, who is driven, and then as a leader, all you have to do is sort of point that person in the right direction, right? And say, go. So if you have somebody that's like, they're just ready to go. Just tell me what to do. And all that person needs is some direction. And once they got the direction, boom, they're going in that direction. And that's what we have here with Apollos. He's fired up. And so all Priscilla and Aquila have to do is say, well, do it this way. Now, you're off a little bit on this baptism thing. And once he gets that, now he's locked in and he's going again. And he's boldly out there sharing this message with people. I think there's a connection between being fervent and being bold. If you're fired up about something, it's hard to be quiet about it, isn't it? It's hard to hold it in. You probably all know somebody like this, that if you ever mention this one subject, just get ready, right? Everybody knows somebody like that? And we have a neighbor that lives down the street, and he's a quiet guy and kind of standoffish, and he hardly talks at all, but he rides a bicycle all the time. You've probably seen him out. You probably passed him somewhere. He's really into that competitive racing and all that kind of stuff. And one day he came by, and usually he doesn't hardly say anything, but he would stop for a minute, and I asked him about his bicycle. Whew, it was probably an hour later we're still out there talking. I mean, he's fired up about talking about that. And that's his passion, right? And we probably all have those subjects ourselves. And maybe, did everybody have a teacher, by the way? And you knew all you had to do to get off for the rest of the day was to bring up a certain subject? Because that's their favorite thing in the world to talk about. So you can just say, how does this relate to? And, you know, hey boy, if you could ever steer into that, yeah, just close the book and sit back and relax, because they're going to go off and get going. Because we have those things that excite us, right? And when you're fervent about something and somebody just mentions the word, you're ready to talk about it. And I think that's the case here for Apollos. And then the question, of course, for ourselves is, are we fired up? Are we excited about our salvation? Peter says, in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect. And so this is the picture of somebody who's ready, right? And then whenever the subject comes up, they're ready to talk about it. They're ready. They're motivated and they're fired up about it. And so they're ready. If somebody asks them, they've got an answer ready to go. And that's a subject that they're ready to discuss when the opportunity presents itself. What happens if our fire dies down? Well, it's not a pretty picture. There's a word for that, right? So if zeo is boiling and hot and glowing and that kind of thing, then what would it be if you turn the heat off and it just sort of simmers down? It'd be lukewarm, right? You remember the picture in Revelation of Christians there? He says, I know your works, you're neither hot or cold. Would that you were either hot or cold, because you're lukewarm. Neither hot or cold, I will spit you out of my mouth. That's a pretty strong reaction. I think the kingdom says vomit, right? I mean, it's a very gross sort of picture of somebody just taking something, drinking something, and spitting it out. Have you ever had that feeling? you thought it was one thing, but it was something else maybe, or you drank it and the milk had curdled or something happened, and you don't even want to swallow it. You want to get it out of your mouth. You're looking for the sink. You're finding somewhere to get this out of your mouth. And that's what he's saying, right? But the reaction that he's having is to someone who's just blah. That it would be better to be cold or hot, just anything other than lukewarm. Maybe people feel that way about coffee, right? A lot of people like iced coffee, and they like hot coffee. Very, very, very few people like a cup of coffee that's just sort of room temperature. That's a very uncommon thing to do. I sort of developed the ability to do that just for fun at work, just because I like to kind of freak everybody out. But I'd go get this coffee pot. It had been shut off since the morning, and I would pour it in there, and I would just drink. It was hard to do. It sounded like a mental test, you know, because it's very, very, it had burnt and be bad, and everybody would be grossed out, but it was just kind of fun to freak people out. But anyway, that's the point here is that this is something that would normally you would want to spit out of your mouth. That it's...